All right, good afternoon and welcome everyone to the ADA Legal Webinar Session. My name is Claudia Diaz and I'm Associate Director at the Great Lakes ADA Center. I'll be moderating for today's session. Before we get started, I would like to cover some of the webinar features. As I mentioned before, we do have closed captioning available. If you are interested in using the captioning, you can click on the CC icon found in your top toolbar, or you can do the keystroke command control F8, and that will bring up a pop-up window that you can adjust to your preferences. I also want to make you aware that we have the chat area available so you can submit questions during the session. The questions will be private, so only moderators and presenters will be seeing those questions. The presenters have designated a question and answer portion where they will address these questions during that time. So please be patient for that time as your questions will get addressed. The presenters will not have the opportunity to stop the presentation to address your questions, so please wait till that designated time. And the last thing I'd like to mention is the emotion icons. Please refrain from using the emotion icons. There will be some slides that will have questions and we will do polling, and please wait for the presenter's instructions on how to access that. But other than that, please refrain from using the emotion icons. With that, I would like to pass over to Barry Taylor and Alan Goldstein from Equip for Equality. They'll be presenting today's session. Barry?
Thanks, Claudia. Hello, everybody. So today we're going to be talking about three issues under the ADA that maybe aren't ones that everybody's familiar with, but are important emerging issues: disability harassment, retaliation, and constructive discharge. And for those of you who've been attending these webinars for a while, might remember that back in 2008, we did a session on these issues, but we wanted to revisit some of these issues because there have been a number of case law developments since that time. Before we get started, we wanted to make sure that people were aware that if you are an Illinois attorney who is attending this webinar, you are eligible to get 1.5 hours of continuing legal education credit. All you need to do in order to get that credit would be to send me an email at barryt@equipforequality.org after the session is over, indicating that you had participated in the 1.5 hours of the training, and then we will follow up with you with your certificate, and we'll have the slide again at the end of the session to remind you where to send that email. So before we get started with all the details, we always like to find out who's attending today, and so we're going to start with question and answer. We want to know if you are A, an advocate for people with disabilities, B, whether you represent employers or other covered entities, or C, none of the above, or innocent, unbiased bystanders. You can click on the A, B, or C button in the participant box, or you can do it on your keyboard with control A, B, or C accordingly. So if you could go ahead and vote now, or let us know now where you fall, and then Alan's going to give us the results. And it should be coming up in just a second. So it looks like about half of you haven't responded yet, which we hope that you'll respond. We have some other interactive features as we go along. But those of you who did respond, it looks like it's about half folks who are advocates for people with disabilities and half who are covered entities. So we have a nice balance today, which is great. Okay, so now we're going to move on to the topics we're going to be addressing today. And as I said, there's three topics. The first one is disability harassment, and we're going to start with that first and look at the following issues: whether disability harassment claims are covered under Title I of the ADA, the legal standard for harassment. We're going to talk about the first two major cases that recognize disability harassment. Then we're going to discuss cases that allow disability harassment cases to proceed, and then those who that dismiss disability harassment claims. We're also going to allow you to vote on whether you think, and sort of act as the judge and jury, whether you think the court or jury found that there was or was not disability harassment. And then we're going to share with you a different way of getting to disability harassment under Title V of the ADA. As I mentioned before, we had this session back in 2008 and created a legal brief. And on this slide is a link to that legal brief. So if you're interested in sort of the more historical aspect of disability harassment and retaliation issues, or are looking to review some of the older cases, that brief might be a useful resource. You'll also be getting this PowerPoint following the session, as well as a new legal brief that updates the research and has all the new cases that have come down since our 2008 presentation. After I finish discussing disability harassment, I'm going to then turn to constructive discharge, which is somewhat related to disability harassment, but this is a situation where the person finds that the conditions are so intolerable that they are forced to quit and were effectively terminated by the employer's actions. And we're going to talk about what is a hostile work environment that would result in constructive discharge, also what other types of working conditions can constitute a constructive discharge, can the denial of reasonable accommodation requests lead to a constructive discharge claim, and then how does the concept of reasonableness factor into constructive discharge claims. At that point, we'll then take a break, see if there's any quick questions that people have, and then Alan will continue and talk about the final topic, which is retaliation. And when he talks about retaliation, he'll focus on the following: who can bring suit for retaliation, whether retaliation claims are limited to current employers, was the employee engaged in a protected activity, which is required for retaliation, what constitutes an adverse employment action, is there a causal connection between the employer's exercise of the protected activity and the employer's adverse action? Was there a non-retaliatory cause for the adverse action? And are damages available in ADA retaliation cases? I also just wanted to give a quick shout out to Rebecca Wiley and Nikki Ashmore, a couple of legal interns that work for us that helped us in preparing the materials for today. So let's move to disability harassment. If you look at the ADA, there's no specific language in the ADA that talks about disability harassment. You're not going to find it as a specific designated cause of action. What you are going to find is what is considered discrimination, and that discrimination is not just limited to job application procedures and hiring and discharge and that type of thing, but also anything that the employer does that alters the term, condition, and privileges of employment. So the bolded words there, terms, conditions, and privileges of employment, are very critical for disability harassment claims. And this really arises from analogy from Title VII, which covers other protected class, like claims based on race and gender and ethnic origin. And the language, if you look at Title VII, is parallel to the ADA in that it also talks about terms, conditions, and privileges of employment. And although we haven't had a disability harassment case go up to the U.S. Supreme Court, the Supreme Court has recognized harassment under Title VII, again, relying on that same language that we see in the ADA. So as you'll see, what the cases do is they relate to the Title VII jurisprudence in finding that there is a claim for disability harassment under the ADA. So people are probably more familiar with claims of sexual harassment and racial harassment, and disability harassment really is the same sort of theory. It's just under a different statute, not Title VII, but the ADA. So in this Title VII jurisprudence and now under the ADA, there really are five factors that a plaintiff has to meet in order to prove that they have a disability harassment claim. The first one is the plaintiff has to show that they're a qualified individual with a disability. Second, that they were subjected to unwelcome harassment. Third, that the harassment was based on the plaintiff's disability, so you have to show a relation. So if the person happens to have a disability and is harassed, but maybe the employer doesn't know they have a disability, they're not going to be able to prove that the harassment was based on disability. It may just be that the employer was harassing because they didn't like the person for other reasons that are unrelated to the disability. So you have to show the relation there. Fourth, you have to show that the harassment was sufficiently severe or pervasive. Those are really important terms, severe or pervasive, to alter a term, condition, or privilege of employment. You see those terms that we talked about before, term, condition, or privilege of employment. And then finally, you have to show that there's some factual basis to impute liability for the harassment to the employer. What we mean by that is that the employer knew or should have known of the harassment, and then once they knew or should have known about it, they didn't take prompt remedial action. As we go through the cases, you're going to find that factor number four is really the key factor that courts focus on and where we have a lot of the arguments going back and forth between the parties. Was the harassment sufficiently severe or pervasive to somehow alter or change something about the employment, the term, a condition, or privilege of employment. And that's where we'll find most of the case law. So as we go through these cases, I want to sort of apologize, I guess, in advance, because many of these cases involve very extreme or vulgar language. And while we normally wouldn't use that type of language in a webinar such as this, unfortunately, it's necessary in order for you to have a true understanding of what the worker experienced and what the court and jury grappled with. So I'm going to be, you know, using some vulgar language, but just know that it's in the context of what happened in the case so that you can understand how it all played out in court. Also, I think it's important to know that disability harassment, especially the severe and pervasive component of disability harassment claims, is a very high standard. And although we're going to show cases where plaintiffs win and plaintiffs lose, frankly, most of the cases the plaintiffs have lost because that standard is so high. So even though we sort of show you a little bit of both cases where plaintiffs win and when they lose, you should know that the majority of these decisions plaintiffs have lost because of this high standard. And the final thing I just wanted to mention is that it's really hard to predict outcomes in these cases because, you know, sometimes you'll have cases that seem pretty extreme harassment and the court won't find that it met the standard, and then you'll have cases that maybe don't have such extreme facts and the court finds that it did meet the standard. So it oftentimes depends on the jurisdiction, maybe the judge or the jury. So while I think the court cases we give to you today are illustrative, they certainly aren't definitive, and every case is examined on its own factual merit. Before 2001, we really didn't have an appellate court decision even recognizing that you could bring a case for disability harassment under the ADA. There were some claims that were made in lower courts, and people were analogizing to the Supreme Court's decisions under Title VII, but in 2001, we finally got two courts of appeals that did recognize that disability harassment was actionable under the ADA, the Fox case out of the Fourth Circuit and the Flowers case out of the Fifth Circuit. And we'd like to talk to you about those two cases. They're rather old, 2001, but they really are the basis for all the subsequent cases for disability harassment. So let's first turn to the Fox case. The Fox case involved a gentleman who worked for General Motors. He had a back injury at work and as a result ended up getting light duty restrictions. And after he had his back injury and had the restrictions, the foreman, who was his supervisor, as well as many other employees, verbally abused Fox. And the foreman in particular used pretty extreme language. After he got his light duty restrictions, and again, I'm quoting here, the foreman said, "How the fuck do you even take a shit with these restrictions?" Pretty extreme and clearly related to his restrictions. So this wasn't just talking, you know, coarsely towards a person, but instead talking coarsely and harassing them based on their disability. He also said, "I don't need any of you handicapped motherfuckers, and you can all go the hell home." Anybody who has restrictions, he also referred to them as hospital people. So it was, you know, very, very extreme, harassing type of language. The foreman also instructed employees not to even speak to Fox. They ostracized him. They wouldn't bring him supplies. And then a very important thing was the foreman also made Fox work at a table that was too low for him because of his back. And it ended up re-aggravating his back injury. And so that's important because it was clear that they were targeting his disability, and it ended up having an adverse physical impact. So the foreman refused to allow Fox to even apply for another position that he was qualified for that would meet his medical restrictions. That would have been a reassignment, reasonable accommodation. And so that action clearly had an adverse consequence for him while he was at work. He ended up suing based on his physical as well as emotional injuries. He sued under a hostile work environment or disability harassment, and the jury found for the plaintiff $200,000 in compensatory damages as well as damages for medical expenses and lost overtime. And then it went up to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and they agreed and affirmed the jury's verdict. So this was really the first circuit court to recognize disability harassment as a cause of action, and they adapted the Title VII's five-factor test, and also, I think importantly, they relied upon the EEOC's regulations for harassment. As I said before, there's no wording of harassment within the ADA itself, but if you look at the EEOC regulations, they say that it's unlawful under the ADA to coerce, threaten, intimidate, harass, or interfere with any individual in the exercise of employment. So they actually use the words harass within the regulations, and the court thought that was important. The court also found that the harassment was severe and pervasive. They said this is not your typical workplace friction. that's unrelated to the disability, but clearly abusive behavior directed attributable to the person's medical condition over a 10-month period. It was clearly not any series of isolated incidents, but more of a prolonged harassment going on. The plaintiff also used the testimony of experts about the physical and emotional injuries that he had, and the court found that was instrumental to him winning his case. I think it was also important that the supervisor was the harasser himself. So that, remember that factor number five where you say the supervisor knew or should have known? Well, here the supervisor was one of the main harassers, so there was no question that management knew or was involved in this. And again, that the employer's action had an adverse impact on the work environment. So then really quickly after that, another Circuit Court of Appeals looked at this issue, the Flowers case, and that involved a woman who was a medical assistant and got along well with her supervisor, but then when Ms. Flowers disclosed that she had HIV, her supervisor became very different in the workplace. She stopped socializing with Flowers, refused to shake her hand, avoided her in the workplace. Her work evaluations changed dramatically after her HIV disclosure. All of a sudden, she was required to submit to multiple drug tests. There was derogatory language from the company president. Just very extreme changes within the workplace. And ultimately, she was discharged, and she sued for disability harassment. So this ultimately went up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and they, like in the Fox case, recognized that disability harassment is a cause of action under the ADA. They followed the same analysis, the Title VII five-factor test, and they found that this harassment was severe and pervasive. But Ms. Flowers had said that she had had actual physical manifestations after she was harassed, but that was after she was terminated. And it wasn't clear whether the physical problems she had were more related to her HIV or as related to the harassment. And since she couldn't prove an actual injury resulting from the harassment while she was at work, that undercut her case. She also claimed that she had emotional harm, but they said you can't just presume emotional harm. So she didn't have the causal connection and the expert witness testimony that Mr. Fox had. And as a result, even though the jury had given her damages initially, the court said, yes, we find that there was disability harassment here, but we don't find that she was actually damaged. So she won, but it was sort of a pyrrhic victory in that there were no damages awarded to her. And again, I think the fact that there wasn't a physical injury or some sort of connection while she was at work, and instead she brought up things that happened after she'd been terminated, really undercut her case. This slide, you have some of the older cases that are in our first brief that I referenced before, where people were allowed to proceed with their disability harassment claim. The Bob Rich case involved somebody who was hard of hearing and received $165,000 in damages based on being harassed in the workplace and forced to resign. The Walmart case involved somebody who had been harassed after having a penile implant and ended up getting $230,000 in damages. It was very extreme conduct by Walmart supervisors and employees. They talked about his penile implant over the loudspeaker in the store. It was horrendous. And so, as you can see, significant damages in that case. The Luby's case involved somebody who had a mental impairment, and the court found that they had stated a harassment claim after being subjected to really awful name calling. They barked at this person at work. There were also threats of violence. We talked about physical injury before, and courts look at that, but they also look at the fact of whether there are threats of violence. So you'll see, even when people don't actually experience physical injury, if there are threats of injury or violence, that can sometimes make the case rise to the level of severe and pervasive. And then the Keeley's case, the defendant in that case said that, you know, they were, this was a particular blue-collar workplace, and it's a place where people just use coarse language and they harass each other all the time, and it's just part of the workplace culture. And the court said that, you know, while there can be coarse language in certain workplaces, this rose above that, and it was clearly related to the person's disability and rose to the level of being severe and pervasive. And then we have some cases from the older brief that give you examples of cases dismissing disability harassment cases. And the Shaver case, I think, is one of those where, when I first read it, I thought for sure this plaintiff is going to win because the conduct was so horrendous towards this person who had a plate put in their head after a brain surgery. They called him Platehead and all kinds of horrible actions towards him in the workplace. But the court found that this was not severe and pervasive. The Mezzi's case had derogatory comments about an employee in the postal office situation who had AIDS, and they found that didn't reach the harassment standard. The Rozier Thompson case reaffirms the point that there was no physical threat or deeply repugnant language in the workplace, so there was no harassment. The Mason case is one where involved the person who was hard of hearing, had the other employees were playing a lot of pranks on him as a result of his hearing impairment. The court found that they were pranks and they didn't rise to the level of harassment, even though they were, you know, very, very mean-spirited. And then the Suarez case sort of rebuts the Quiles case, which talked about the blue-collar workplace. They said, you know, a workplace is not a cocoon, and those who labor in it are expected to have reasonably thick skins. And so they said the fact that people are sometimes difficult in the workplace towards each other is something that we tend to expect and will not necessarily rise to the level of harassment. So let's look at a few of the more recent cases. The Davis case is really recent, came out just a few months ago out of Vermont, and again a case involving pretty extreme situation. This involved a prison guard. He had injured his groin and testicles at work, and while he was on recovery, his supervisor sent two staff-wide offensive emails referencing the guard's injury. One of the emails contained a picture of an individual with his testicle showing, and then they superimposed the plaintiff's face on the picture. And not only did staff see these emails, but inmates saw them as well. And then there were all kinds of things left in his mailbox, as well as like a cartoon that was placed. One had a cartoon, a picture of a person with a gun to his head saying you should just kill yourself. Really extreme stuff, and you know, the threat of violence was clearly here. Interestingly, he was ridiculed not only by staff and supervisors but also by the prisoners, and they would make various disparaging comments to him as well. So he ended up suing under the ADA for disability harassment, and even though some of the incidents were deemed sporadic, they weren't maybe as consistently happening as in some of the other cases, they said they were so severe that it could constitute disability harassment and his case could continue to go forward. The court also seemed to rely upon the fact that all of this problem in the workplace were perpetuated by the supervisors. And another thing that I think they looked at in this case is that as a result of the harassment, it really interfered with an essential function of his job. And what they explained in this case was that prison guards really need to rely upon their coworkers to stay safe, and that he really couldn't feel like he could rely upon his coworkers because they were so abusive to him and were ostracizing him. And so what he needed to have back up from other prison guards, he didn't have because of the harassment, and that really adversely affected him in the workplace. And they also said, you know, generally, prison officials aren't held responsible for the conduct of inmates in most cases, but here, because the inmates would not have known about the guard's disability and all this horrible stuff they sent out, if it hadn't been for the supervisors disclosing the injury, you know, that was really the connection here. And so the fact that there was harassment by inmates was deemed relevant, even though that typically would not be relevant in these kinds of cases. So he was able to proceed with his disability harassment case. Another case that was successful with the plaintiff is the Schwarzkopf case. This involved a gentleman who had mental illness, depression, and anxiety disorder, and things were going fine in the workplace, but once he disclosed his disability, things got very different, and he began being called a lot of different names, especially by his supervisor: stupid, idiot, mental case, dumb, incompetent, and it was done on a very consistent basis. To tie it sort of more closely to his disability, he was starting to receive Social Security disability benefits, and the supervisor said that people who receive Social Security disability benefits are worthless pieces of shit. And so, you know, again, a connection to the disability, so that wasn't really an issue here. And then on the threats of violence, he said to the plaintiff several times that he wanted to put a shock collar on him because he was so forgetful as a result of his mental illness. And then they had a shouting match, and the supervisor actually made a slashing motion across his neck, indicating a threat of violence as well. As a result of all the conduct that the plaintiff experienced here, he had to go on medical leave to recover from the anxiety. So unlike the the Flowers case, where all the negative things happened to the person after they were terminated. This person went on leave and had extreme situations before ultimately voluntarily resigning from the position. He ended up suing not only for harassment but also retaliation and constructive discharge, and the court ultimately denied summary judgment that the defendant was seeking and found that the plaintiff's hostile work environment claim or disability harassment claim could go forward. The court said that the comments were routinely made by supervisors. Again, it was not just co-workers, but supervisors as well, and a clear connection between the adverse conduct and the damages that he had, the increased anxiety and depression. And he wasn't able to succeed with his constructive discharge claim because he couldn't prove that the supervisor was trying to force him out or force him to quit, but he could proceed with his disability harassment claim. Another fairly recent case from 2009 involved a driver who also had mental illness who worked for UPS. And once it was disclosed that she had mental illness, she became harassed by her co-workers. They were always asking her if she'd taken her medication. She felt like she got wrongly accused of not following certain procedures because of her mental illness. They observed some conduct and thought, well, she needs to have a functional capacity exam, which she didn't think she needed. She was asked all the time, why aren't you on FMLA? You miss work all the time anyway. They tried to terminate her, but ultimately through a grievance, she was put back and just had a written warning, but she was demoted. And so she filed an allegation for disability harassment. But in this case, the court found that the conduct was not sufficiently severe or pervasive to constitute actionable harassment. It was not deemed to happen regularly. It was more sporadic instead of pervasive. And so she was not able to proceed with her claim. And then the Colon Fontanez case out of Puerto Rico involved an employee with fibromyalgia who was doing well at work but experienced some pretty extreme pain. And she disclosed her absence after she had had a number of absences, and her supervisor's conduct towards her changed dramatically. The supervisor refused to meet with the employee or put other employees ahead of her. Refused to greet her in the office, yelled at her, threw her out of the office in front of other staff, and then refused to address the fact that other coworkers were being harassing, accusing the plaintiff of faking it, calling her a hypochondriac, that type of thing. So this is one where the supervisor knew about it and failed to take action, factor five that we talked about. They even followed her when she was taking bathroom breaks. And the court said that while the conduct here was unprofessional, it wasn't severe and pervasive enough to constitute harassment. They felt that the evidence didn't support a hostile work environment claim. They found that the incidents were episodic but not very frequent. They were upsetting but not severe. They were mildly humiliated but not physically threatening. So again, the physical aspect of things enters into the analysis here. And then another key point that we haven't really talked about is that the acts by the employer here did not appear to affect her overall work performance. And in fact, when she testified, she said that she was able to continue her work despite all the harassment. And so it was hard for her to show that the harassing conduct had altered a term, condition, or privilege of her employment, because she was still performing well despite the harassment. So that's sort of a tricky thing for plaintiffs to have to say. They have to talk about how it adversely impacted their employment, even though that might show that they weren't doing a good job. So that's a tricky tight wire that plaintiffs have to walk in these kinds of cases. But since she couldn't show an adverse impact on the condition benefit of employment, she couldn't continue with her claim. So now we're going to have a few you be the judge and jury cases. And I'm going to just give you some background on the case, and then you can say yes, whether you think the case was able to proceed under disability harassment, or no, the court threw it out. And so the first one is the Murphy case. This was a dispatcher who had multiple sclerosis and used a cane and had experienced some difficulties in the workplace, including difficulties controlling his bladder. And then due to the bowel accidents at work, he got called horrible names by his co-workers, including Mr. Shitty. They left a child's book about feces on his desk called The Book of Poop. And co-workers also hit his cane and drew caricatures that were put up in the dispatch area. One of the caricatures depicted him as a Special Olympian with a cane, and another listed him as Stupid Employee of the Month. And so that was the the harassing conduct that he had had, the supervisor said that the pictures were just to reflect people's personalities in the workplace and that he was taking it, you know, too seriously. So let's take a second to vote. In the box there, you'll see a green check. You can vote yes if you think that the court found that there was harassment, or if you think no, click the red X. Or you can do Control A for yes, or Control B for no. So vote now. Do you think there was disability harassment claim was allowed to proceed? Green check, yes. Red X, no. And as you'll see, for those of you who voted, overwhelmingly thought that the court said yes. The case should continue for disability harassment. Unfortunately for Mr. Murphy, the court did not agree with most of you, and in fact found that what had happened to him in the workplace was not severe or pervasive to affect his ability to do his job. They said that the cane hiding incident was an isolated incident, and it wasn't indicative of a hostile work environment, but really workplace pranks. So again, we don't have the threat of violence here. We don't have something showing that it adversely affected his employment. And so as a result, the horrible conduct he had, while certainly offensive to all of you, did not rise in the court's view to disability harassment. Let's do another one of those, the Lowenstein case. This involved a pharmacist who told her supervisor that she had an autoimmune disorder and that she had to be out for medical absences. And one doctor said that it would be fine to have a doctor's note, but another supervisor decided that hospitalization was not an excuse for missing work, and so her doctor's note were rejected. And even during 1 month alone, the plaintiff's supervisor rejected 5 different doctor's notes, and that ended up resulting in disciplinary proceedings against the plaintiff. Ultimately, she was fired for violating the attendance policy, but that was because they wouldn't accept her doctor's notes. So the question is that disability harassment, yes or no? So you can click the green check for yes, the red X for no. Let's vote here. And our results should be coming up. More of an even split, but for those of you who voted, about half said no, and a little bit more than half said yes. And in fact, those of you who said yes are correct here. Even though maybe the conduct doesn't feel as horrible as the previous case, what we have here are disciplinary proceedings against the plaintiff who was attempting in good faith to comply with the company policy. And so the court said that was sufficiently severe to affect the job and constitute harassment. So the fact that there was a consequence to the employment related to her disability, not taking the doctor's notes, was enough to proceed with a disability harassment claim. So again, that altering a term, condition, or privilege of employment is the key factor that the court looked at in this case. And then the last case we'll look at for disability harassment is EEOC versus Rite Aid. This involved an employee who had epilepsy, had recurring seizures, including grand mal and complex partial seizures. He was ultimately restrained by coworkers during one seizure, and they photographed him in boxer shorts during another seizure. As his seizures increased, his employer started questioning whether maybe he was just an alcoholic or drinking too much. They were asking him if he was on his medication, and coworkers had allegedly ridiculed him. He was also placed on restricted work duty, despite documentation from his neurologist that it was not necessary for him to have these restrictions. So what do you think? Is that disability harassment? Green check, yes. Red X, no. Go ahead and vote now. Most of you said yes in this case who voted, and that's how I would have voted too if I had seen this case, but this court said no. They said even though the conduct was offensive and humiliating, it was not a hostile work environment because you couldn't prove that the employers intended to ridicule him on account of his disability. I just can't agree with this court analysis because it was clearly about his seizure disorder. It was related to the disability. The restraint to me feels like the physical components, the fact that they were placed on restricted work duty affected a condition of his employment. So to me, if you ran through all the analysis that we had talked about, you should have been able to find disability harassment here. But again, as we talked about before, these cases are all over the map because of the different judges and juries looking at these cases. Before we leave disability harassment, we wanted to let you know that there is an alternative way to bring a disability harassment claim, and that is under Title V of the ADA, which we really don't talk about usually in ADA analysis. But Title V has a number of provisions that can impact people with disabilities, including retaliation that Alan will talk about in a little bit. And Title V says that it's unlawful to coerce, intimidate, threaten, or interfere with any individual in the exercise or enjoyment of any right granted or protected by the employer. It doesn't say harassment, but Mark Weber, a professor here in Chicago at DePaul, has written a book. You'll see the picture of his book, Disability Harassment, that goes through this. And he argues that Title V is another way to bring a disability harassment claim and have a lower standard than the current severe and pervasive standard, that verbal harassment or insults or threats would suffice even if it's not severe and pervasive, and that you don't even have to prove the person has a disability under Title V. However, most people have not taken this route. There's very limited case law under Title V, so even though this is, in theory, something that people could use, so far courts have really not seen these kinds of cases brought. But if you are bringing a harassment case in the future, I would strongly consider looking at Title V. And if you look at the brief that you're going to get after this session, we have more analysis on this issue. So let's quickly turn to the constructive discharge aspect, and then we'll stop for questions. Constructive discharge is often related to harassment. You frequently see people filing under both harassment as well as constructive discharge. But constructive discharge is harder because you have to show that the conditions are so bad it compelled the plaintiff to quit. So a person could win a harassment case and still lose their disability constructive discharge case, like the Schwarzkopf case we referenced before. So you'll see here that the constructive discharge standard is that the working conditions have to be so difficult or unpleasant that a reasonable person in employee's shoes would have felt compelled to resign. And some examples are forced resignation, employer harassment, repeated denials of reasonable accommodation request, and a materially adverse change in job duties. And so the analysis is really a two-part analysis. First, a reasonable person in the position would have felt compelled to quit under the intolerable work conditions. And second, the employer acted with intent for the employee to quit, or that he could have reasonably foreseen that the employee would quit as a result of the actions in the workplace. We'll give you a few examples, and then we'll do a few more judges, and then we'll open up for questions. The Chavez case involves a woman who was a teacher. She had paralyzed vocal cords due to a brain tumor, and she claimed that she was constructively discharged after a number of things happened to her. She got reassigned to substitute status instead of being full-time, and they failed to provide a number of accommodations like an effective microphone or computer software that would allow her to amplify her voice. She actually got her own software and asked to put it on. They didn't respond, so she put it on anyway, and then she got discipline for using the software without permission, even though they were the ones who failed to respond to her. They also came into her class all the time, observing her, which disrupted her classroom teaching. And then they said, well, you should just use a headset. And she said, that's going to irritate my brain surgery scar. And they said, well, just tape a cushion to the headset and you'll be fine. So the court said this is one-sided harassment. It constituted constructive discharge. We weren't really sure when we watched this, when we read this case, what exactly one-sided harassment is, you know, because that implies that there's two-sided harassment, and you're not going to see that. But the court found that the supervisor should have reasonably believed that the plaintiff would quit since she could not effectively teach without the accommodation. So this is an example of not providing accommodations that result in constructive discharge. The Gingold case is another constructive discharge case, but this time the plaintiff lost. The computer technician involved in this case had mental illness, including panic attacks, and the employer had started a new rotating schedule that would require technicians to travel. And the plaintiff said, you know, I have real concerns about that because of my anxiety. And the manager said, well, let's try to work on this and figure out, you know, where you're able to travel without anxiety, and submitted to him some different options, including a location that did not have a rotating schedule. But before the defendant could get the plaintiff to consider this, the plaintiff just resigned and said, I can't work in these conditions. And the court said, look, you know, the defendant was trying here, and they said that the plaintiff's constructive discharge isn't going to proceed because it was the plaintiff who ended the interactive process and resigned before any adverse employment action had happened. And so the court found that a reasonable person in his position would not have felt compelled to resign because the defendant here was being cooperative and attempting an accommodation. So the tip here is that, you know, resignation should be a decision of last resort after all alternatives have been exhausted. And if you quit before you've explored all the alternatives, you're likely not to win your constructive discharge case. So let's do a couple more you be the judge and jury on constructive discharge cases, and then we'll open up for questions. The first one is the Lara case. This involved a person who was a custodian for a school and had had several periods of leave after having a ruptured aneurysm, a heart attack, and abdominal hernia. The HR person at the school had told the plaintiff that he was too old, he was getting on in age, maybe should just take early retirement, you're missing too much work, you've got too many medical programs, and you're costing the school a lot of money because of it. And he ended up retiring, saying that he felt forced in retiring based on the conduct that he experienced from the HR professional. So the question is, do you think this rises to the level of constructive discharge? Was it so intolerable that the plaintiff should had no other alternatives but to resign or to retire? If you think yes, green check. No, red X. Everybody vote. And the results will be coming up in a second. And you voted correctly, those of you who said no. The court here found that the conditions were not so intolerable that it had no other choice but to quit. So this is a case where the plaintiff could not meet that higher standard that we talked about. Another case, the Sensing case, involved a woman who was a hostess for Outback Steakhouse. She had diabetes and MS. And when her MS would flare up, she had a very difficult time walking or feeding herself, and she would have to be bedridden. And when she disclosed this to the manager that she had, particularly the MS, and had some experiencing numbness in her legs, the manager sort of had an extreme reaction. And even though she was able to work, the manager sent her home, covered her next few shifts, even though she said she wanted to come back. She even presented a doctor's note saying that she could come back, but they refused to put her back on the schedule. And ultimately, the manager said, look, maybe if you go through a fitness for duty, we'll let you come back. But even though the plaintiff agreed to do that and tried to participate, the manager never scheduled her back. And ultimately, she left because she couldn't get back on the schedule. There was really no opportunity for her. So do you think this rose to the level of constructive discharge? Yes or no? Green check for yes, red X for no. And here, most of you said yes. 29 said yes, and 2 said no. And those of you who said yes would be correct, because here you can show that it did alter her employment. The employer made it impossible for her to work, refused to put her on the schedule, refused to schedule the functional examination. And so the employer's actions really effectively terminated her, even though she was the one who actually resigned because she couldn't get back on the schedule. Good. One last case, and we'll open it up for questions, the Tally case. This involved a cashier who had osteoarthritis of the spine, which caused some extreme pain in the legs and back and limited her ability to stand for long periods of time. And even though some managers allowed her to use a stool while she did the cashier duties, one manager said she could not use a stool, and he cited the fact that other employees had complained that she was receiving unfair treatment, and which, you know, by itself is improper to use other employees' reactions to an accommodation as a basis for denying the accommodation. She tried to work without a stool, but after 2 hours she had to go home because the pain had gotten so severe. She did come back with a doctor's note saying that the stool would help her with her accommodation of her disability, but the manager just refused to even read the note. He said he would schedule a time to discuss the accommodation, but never returned the calls to schedule the meeting. She never was able to return after turning in the manager or the doctor's note, and ended up being terminated 5 months later for abandoning her position. So do you think that this was a constructive discharge? Or were the conditions so intolerable that she had no other options but to resign? Yes, green check. No, red X. Go ahead and vote now. And we'll see the results. 20 of you said yes, and 5 said no, and those of you who said 20 would be correct. The employer's action, the court said, could be viewed by a reasonable person as an intentional action to force the plaintiff to quit. It was foreseeable that the plaintiff would quit when her accommodation was rejected as an alternative, and she would continue to suffer extreme pain if not given the accommodation. So again, another example where the employment was altered by the employer's action and made it so intolerable that she was in such pain without the accommodation that she had no other option but to quit. That leads us to the time to stop for questions. If you have any questions, you can type it into the box, and we will respond to it. And we'll also have time for questions at the end as well. So Alan, I don't know if you saw any questions that came in that you want to start answering, or I can scroll up.
Okay, at this time we're taking questions. I'd just like to encourage people to write your question in the chat area at this time.
Great. Somehow my microphone went off. I'm sorry. Let me go ahead and reread that question. I don't think anybody heard me. So here's a question. Let's say a supervisor is informed by the ADA coordinator that accommodations have been identified for the employee. If the supervisor then goes to the employee and asks what the disability is or what's wrong with him or her, is that an unnecessary inquiry that's severe enough to be an ADA violation even though it's a one-time incident? Well, I think it's going to be tough to show that that's a harassment, because it's, especially sometimes the supervisor would be within the realm of somebody who is in the need-to-know kind of component. And so I think with respect to harassment or constructive discharge, that wouldn't be. But if you can show somehow the supervisor didn't have a need to know and they were doing an unlawful inquiry, you could have a basis for a claim on that. It looks like Alan sort of answered similar to that. So Alan, feel free to jump in if you have any additional thoughts. And it looks like that's really the only question we have at this point. So I want to make sure that Alan has sufficient time. We will have more time to talk about harassment and constructive discharge at the end, but why don't we turn it over to Alan at this point to talk about retaliation. Okay, Alan has sent me a note that his mic has stopped working. So Alan, if you want to come to my office and you can use my mic, I'll get started here. And then you can jump in. So retaliation, as I mentioned before, is covered by Title V of the ADA. And Title V says that no person shall discriminate against an individual because such individual has opposed any act or practice made unlawful by this act, or because such individual made a change, testified, assisted, or participated in any manner in an investigation, proceeding, or hearing under this act. And really the rationale behind this is it provides a protection for employees who exercise their civil rights, and it promotes the full and fair enforcement of the ADA. So what this really is providing, and this is something we see not only under the ADA but other civil rights laws, is that if people take action to exercise their civil rights and they then receive some sort of adverse action in the workplace that's connected to their disability, that can be a basis for a retaliation claim. So the first thing we're going to look at is who can bring retaliation claims, and Alan is going to take over the microphone at this point. Here's Alan.
Okay, while they get set up with the microphone, I turned off Barry's mic, but when you're ready, Alan, go ahead and turn on the mic.
Hello?
Hi, we can hear you.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. We're on slide 42, who can bring retaliation claims. It's not necessarily limited to people with disabilities. The majority of courts have found that proving that the individual bringing the claim has a disability is not required in retaliation cases, because the language in the ADA refers to any person rather than any qualified individual with a disability. And we have the Schellenberger case down there, which was an employee with allergies who claimed she was terminated for filing an ADA charge with the EEOC. And the court held in that case that Title V does not require proof of an ADA disability to bring a retaliation case. On the next slide, we asked a question, are retaliation claims limited to only current employers? Could it be someone suing their employer after they leave the employment? And usually the retaliation occurs while the plaintiff is still an employee. But if a former employee may also bring a claim, and we have the Carr versus Morgan County School case there, where a teacher settled an ADA claim after filing with the EEOC, the school administrator revealed a problem with the employee during a reference check, and the court refused to dismiss the claim for retaliation, finding that an adverse action would include harm to a former employee's future employment prospects. So when the employer mentioned problems during a reference check, it was found to be possible retaliation, even though the comments were about a former employee. And then looking at the Fogelman case, which also involved someone who was not the employee, this was the son of a former employee. It was a son who worked at the hospital where his father had previously worked. The son brought a retaliation claim alleging that he was fired because his father had previously filed an ADA discrimination case when the father worked at the hospital. The issue before the court was, does the ADA prohibit an adverse employment action against a third party in retaliation for another person's protected activity? So the question is the son protected by the anti-retaliation provisions when it was the father who filed the ADA claim? And the court cited the statute on retaliation, which is down there, 42 U.S.C. 12203B. A contains a general retaliation claim. This is the second anti-retaliation provision, which also protects people who have aided or encouraged any other individual in the exercise or enjoyment of any right guaranteed by this chapter. The court deeming that the son could be seen as someone who aided or encouraged his father in the previous ADA claim, and hence the subsequent actions against him could violate the ADA. The next issue we need to look at in establishing retaliation is whether the employee was engaged in a protected activity. And that's the first element that a plaintiff needs to claim in the ADA case. Essentially, in retaliation, there are four elements of the case. The employee needs to show that they were engaged in a protective activity, suffered an adverse employment action, the defendant was aware of the protected activity, and that there is a causal link between the protective activity and the adverse employment action. So was the employee engaged in the protective activity, the first step? So some protected activities include the textbook one is filing a lawsuit or a charge of discrimination with a federal, state, or local agency. And many of the cases in the brief and that we've looked at involve situations where an employee has filed an EEOC charge and then been subject to adverse employment action subsequent to that filing. Any actions taken in retaliation, though, it doesn't have to be that formal level. If an employee requests reasonable accommodations and there's retaliation based on that request, that could also be actionable under Title V. Or if an individual assists or otherwise participates in an investigation of discrimination, that can be actionable as well. And then there has to be a causal connection. Does the retaliation claim relate to the protected activity? So when an employee terminated or an employee was terminated for confronting and complaining to an employer, that was not considered a protected activity because it did not concern any disability-related issues. So just the fact that someone has a disability, it's not a cloak of invincibility in terms of termination. If someone's terminated, the employee needs to show that there was a connection between their protected activity and the action taken by the employer. In the Block case, an employee was fired after opposing an employer's request for health info, and that was also found not to be a protected activity. There was no causal connection between the employee's action and the ADA. It was a request for health information, and the employee was deemed more to be insubordinate than engaging in a protected activity. In the Mosley case, the court found that an employee filed a workers' compensation claim and that the employee was not protected, that filing a workers' compensation claim is not a protected activity. I would like to emphasize that that actually depends on state law. So under the federal law, the court found that there was no retaliation. But I know, for example, in Illinois, individuals who are retaliated against for filing workers' compensation claims are protected under state law. So that's another avenue to look at. In the Sanchez case, an employee was terminated after requesting a reasonable accommodation, and the court said that that was a protected activity for the basis of his retaliation claim. On to the next slide. The second element is there has to be an adverse employment action. Does that adverse employment action need to be actual termination, or is an adverse employment action short of termination still enough to bring a case? And the courts were split prior to the Burlington Northern case from the U.S. Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court resolved that split that says that any action that materially injures or harms an employee who has complained of discrimination and would dissuade a reasonable worker from making a charge of discrimination, that could be the basis of a retaliation claim. So that resolved the split, and any adverse employment action can then give rise to a retaliation claim. In the Norden case, an employee was required to waive his right to file EEO complaints in order to return to work. The court deemed that waiving this federal right was an adverse employment action. The Gilmore case, and just one, so you know, the sites where there is no, for example, the FSUP or the numbers after it, those cases are in the earlier brief that Barry referenced, whereas the cases where there is a full citation, those cases are ones that are in the more recent brief that you'll receive. So just so you know, if you're looking for the cases, that'll help you know where to look. In the Gilmore versus Potter case, after filing an EEO complaint, it was a post office employee. Federal employees must file with the Equal Employment Opportunity Officer for that agency, rather than with the EEOC itself. After filing that complaint, the employee was isolated in a small room, threatened with termination, called worthless, and told not to talk to her court workers. It was a decision I found a little surprising. The court said this was not an adverse action. There have been other cases where employees were isolated in certain situations, and courts have gone the other direction on that, but in this case, they did not. In Sereno versus the U.S. Postal Service, a transfer was deemed not to be an adverse action, but it was actually an effort to accommodate the employee. Remember that reassignment can be an accommodation under the ADA, and employers have discretion in terms of which accommodation they provide, as long as they provide one that's effective. In Williams versus Brunswick, the court deemed there was no employment or no adverse employment action because the employee did not lose any benefits or pay. It's important, sometimes people are put on leave as a result of requesting an accommodation, and it's important to check because some courts might deem placing a person on leave to be an adverse employment action, whereas other courts might not. The argument that it would be an adverse employment action would be that people don't get promoted from leave, and if they're receiving some pay or sick pay, you don't get promoted, you can't advance in your job, so being on leave is deemed by many courts to be an adverse employment action. And then it's also important to remember that the ADA applies also to labor organizations. And the Infantolino case there, so that the union engaged in retaliation when it cut off an electrician's health care benefits and refused to provide job referrals after he filed an EEOC charge. On to slide 49. We have the Larkin case. Where there's a whole list of actions there, and the court deemed that these were not materially adverse employment actions, and that they would not dissuade a reasonable person from engaging in a protected activity. And it's important to remember we use an objective standard here. Would a reasonable person be dissuaded from engaging in the activity? It doesn't matter whether the employee themselves would dissuade it or not, but you have to use the reasonable person standard. Here, a high school teacher with alcoholism requested a transfer to an elementary school and alleged that the employer, the school district, failed to engage in the interactive process, failed to transfer her, forced her to endure a sham interview process, gave her unsatisfactory and undeserved negative performance reviews, accused her of failing to provide the results of her blood alcohol test when she did actually provide those, initially refusing to grant FMLA leave, which is not discretionary, insisting that she return to the high school against medical advice, and they accused her of not engaging in the interactive process, but the court deemed that these did not arise to be adverse employment action for purposes of retaliation. And then the third element is there needs to be a causal connection between the protected activity and then the employer's adverse action against the employee. The plaintiffs must show that causal connection, for example, filing an EEOC action, between that action and the employer's adverse action. And courts often look at the timing. What's the temporal proximity? Did the employer engage in the alleged adverse action days after an employee filed an EEOC claim, or was it months or years later? And sometimes that timing issue, the temporal proximity, is what leads the court to decide one way or the other. So here are some cases. These are from the old briefs. In the Satchel case, there was no retaliation when the termination occurred 2 years after an employee requested an accommodation. In the Herbal case, the claim for retaliation was allowed to proceed when the supervisor's behavior changed soon after. I believe in that case it was a period of weeks or maybe a month and a half or so after the filing of the EEOC charge. And in the Travis case, the employee was disciplined for attendance problems and altercations with coworkers. But here, in this case, the discipline occurred before the employee filed with the EEOC, so there could be no retaliation claim there because the discipline, the alleged retaliatory act, predated the EEOC filing. In the Ryan case, it's a case involved an inspection technician who had been mispaid for 25 years and was terminated 3 days after complaining about having to undergo a functional capacity evaluation, an FCE. And the employer required the FCE due to some accommodations requested by the employee after a work-related accident. And courts often do find that some type of medical evaluation may be a reasonable thing when accommodations are requested. So the functional capacity exam itself was not an issue, but the employee complained that during the functional capacity evaluation they had to do tasks they did not have to perform on the job. And that's what the employee complained about, is that the FCE was not really useful because he was doing tasks he didn't have to do on the job, so it wasn't really evaluating his fitness for work. And when he was fired 3 days after that, the court deemed that that was a temporal proximity and that the firing was causally connected to the complaint about the FCE. In Colon-Fontanes, the court held there was no retaliation when an employer removed an employee's computer and the employee said it was for repair and cleaning. It wasn't in retaliation for the reasonable accommodation request of a reserved parking space. And in this case, they kind of went back and forth, but the employee really didn't have a response to that claim by the employer. In the Williams case, the court said there was no retaliation when an employer filed an employee for taking leave, but the firing occurred 16 months after the employee filed an EEOC charge of discrimination. At that length of time led the court to conclude that there was no causal connection. In the Bliss case, an assistant manager wore a cast on her arm for an extended period. It was not a simple fracture. She had, I think, 6 different surgeries on the arm and had to wear the cast for an extended period. At some point, they had a good relationship, and then at some point, that relationship with a supervisor deteriorated. And she filed a charge with the EEOC alleging that she was being harassed and discriminated against by her supervisor. Less than a month after filing the EEOC charge, the plaintiff was fired for allegedly violating the employee discount policy by allowing her friend to purchase a tie using her discount, which she claims was pretext that she was actually fired for filing the EEOC charge. The court granted summary judgment for the employer on the discrimination and harassment claims, but denied it on the retaliation claim due to the temporal proximity between the filing and the termination. So the charge was filed at the EEOC, then less than a month later she was terminated, allegedly for violating the workplace rules, which she claimed was pretext. But the court looked at the one-month time span between the EEOC filing and the termination and deemed that was enough to at least get past summary judgment in terms of whether there was retaliation and a causal connection. When you talk about pretext, generally what happens is an employer claims that they had a reason to fire the employee. We didn't fire them for filing the EEOC charge. We fired them because they sold something to their friend and let them use the discount. And an employee can defeat that claim by showing that the employer's reason was not valid, as actually a pretext for the adverse employment action. So the employer tries to show a legitimate business reason for the adverse employment action, and then the burden shifts back to the employee to show that the employer's asserted non-retaliatory reason is really not legitimate and was actually a pretext for discrimination. So in the Oslak case, the employer provided a non-retaliatory reason for the termination. They said that it was due to the employee's behavior, that he was engaging improperly. I believe there was insubordination involved and problems with coworkers, and that the termination did not relate to his medical status, and the court deemed that that reason was valid, and the employee did not rebut that to show it was not a legitimate claim. In the Hughes case, the retaliation claim also failed when the employer had a legitimate reason for termination. In this case, the employee called in sick from Las Vegas. You know, the employer said, I guess you should stay in Las Vegas this time. And in the Mitchell case, the employer had a valid reason for referral to the employee assistance program as an employee was acting disruptive and intimidating, and the court deemed that that was a legitimate business reason for the referral to the EAP. And then in the Monteroso case, we look more at pretext. An employee had chemical and environmental sensitivities, and we're certainly seeing more case filings and more interest in things like a sensory workplace. And this employee filed an EEOC charge after the employer refused to accommodate her request for a propellant-free workplace. Less than 3 months after filing the EEOC charge, the employee was paid on unpaid administrative leave and fired a few months later. The court held that this established a prima facie case, at least a basic case for retaliation against the employer, and then the burden shifts the employer to show a legitimate reason for the termination. In this case, the employer said, oh, we terminated her for chronic absences, not for retaliation for filing the EEOC charge. And the employee did not have any did not rebut this claim at all. I think, and for that reason, the court ruled that there was no pretext and accepted the employer's reason. You know, I think here the employee may have been able to go farther and show that it was the lack of the accommodation that led to her having breathing difficulties, that led to her missing work, and try to establish that causal connection that way. But she did not do that sufficiently here, and the court upheld the termination. And we'll look at pretext in the Dickerson case. A custodian received an unsatisfactory performance evaluation and was told he needed to improve his relationship with people and the quantity of work that he did. He refused to sign the evaluation as he disagreed with it and filed a grievance with the union, saying the evaluation was discriminatory and disciplined for his union activities. He also filed a charge with the EEOC after he was not promoted to a full-time position. 6 months later, the employee received another poor evaluation and was then fired. In this case, the court affirmed summary judgment for the employer, although the employee did engage in a protected activity following the EEOC charge, and there was a connection between that activity and the adverse employment action, the termination. The court held that the employer did have a legitimate reason for terminating the custodian as he did not meet the required expectations of his job, which is required under the ADA. Everyone has to be qualified to perform their essential functions with or without accommodations. And here the employee's workplace issues, the court deemed was a legitimate reason for the termination. And then the last question we'll look at is, are damages available in ADA retaliation cases? And there's a split in the courts. Courts have differed whether employees can recover money damages for retaliation. Historically, money damages, and remember a lot of the ADA's damages provisions relate to and come from the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And historically, monetary damages were not recoverable in the Civil Rights Act, and the Civil Rights Act of 1991, the updated version, does provide for monetary damages when the defendant has engaged in unlawful intentional discrimination. Some courts have held that this provision also encompasses retaliation. One additional implication, if a plaintiff does not have a claim of damages, then they will not be able to have a jury trial. So for many plaintiffs, it's important to be able to put the damage claim out there, one, to compensate them for any injuries they suffered, as that's how we compensate people for injuries, but two, you only get a jury trial under the ADA if there's claims for damages. You can't get a jury for injunctive relief or anything else. So it's very important for plaintiffs to be able to seek damages. In the Kramer case, which in the Seventh Circuit, here in Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, was deemed a case of first impression in the federal courts, which looked at whether compensatory damages could be awarded in a retaliation case under the ADA and the 1991 version of the Civil Rights Act. And the Seventh Circuit held that the ADA does not provide a plaintiff with compensatory damages. The court reasoned that the new language in the 1991 version of the Civil Rights Act was specific to discrimination cases only, and relates that to Title I of the ADA, but said that that new provision did not include retaliation cases, which again are found under Title V of the ADA. In another court, in the Rumla case, the district court in Florida said that compensatory damages were appropriate based on the context of the retaliation claim. The court said that the statutes do not have to be read literally, and recognize that other courts have held that it is unnecessary for Congress to separately mention retaliation remedies. That court taking a little more liberal view of the statutory language and coming to a different decision than the Seventh Circuit did. In the Baker case, the court, the Sixth Circuit disagreed with the Seventh Circuit and held that retaliation is an intentional discriminatory act, and therefore a plaintiff can recover money damages. And it based its decision on discussions and something sometimes called referred to as dicta, some additional language in three other Supreme Court cases involving anti-discrimination laws. And for those of you interested in researching those three Supreme Court cases, they are listed in the brief you'll receive. But the Baker case, the reasoning in that case was rejected by a different circuit court, the Ninth Circuit, in the Alvarado case, where the court agreed with the Seventh Circuit and Kramer that there are no compensatory damages. So summing up, Sixth Circuit, yes, damages. Seventh and Ninth, no, for retaliation. In the Leone case, the plaintiff requested that the court adopt the ADA discrimination standard in retaliation claims. That compensatory and punitive damages are appropriate where the employer has engaged in intentional discrimination and has done so with malice or reckless indifference to the federally protected rights of the plaintiff. But this court followed the approach of the Ninth and Seventh Circuits and rejected the request because it was unclear if the plaintiff could even establish the discrimination was malicious or reckless. Now we're going to get to some practical tips, and then we'll have a little time at the end for questions. So first, we have some tips for employees with disabilities. One, with harassing or retaliatory conduct, it's very important to complain right away to your supervisor, or if it's your supervisor who's engaging in the conduct, to complain to the person over your supervisor, so that the employer has knowledge of discriminatory conduct occurring in the workplace. Very important to keep good documentation of harassment or retaliation. We encourage clients to keep a little journal, document things daily. If other people are around and they witness it, make sure you know who's around, because a lot of these come down to he said, she said types of situations. The more proof you have, the more detailed information, the more witnesses, all those things can help you establish your case. Be aware of the statute of limitations. You know, under Title I of the ADA, a person must file a charge with the EEOC within 300 days of the alleged discrimination. Federal employees must file or at least notify the EEO officer within 45 days. State laws may have different statutes of limitations. For retaliation, I think I might generally follow the civil rights or personal injury statute in that state, so for many states that might be 2 years. So depending on what title of the ADA you're going on under, you must be aware of the statute of limitations. If there are physical injuries arising from the harassment that were incurred during employment, keep evidence of any physical injuries. If it's something physical like bruising or cuts, take pictures. Get medical treatment, obviously, for any injury. If it's something more emotional, internal, people who have physical injuries, whether mental or physical, should seek treatment and have that treated and documented. And again, simply leaving a job is not enough to give rise to a constructive discharge claim. You have to show that the work environment was intolerable that would lead a reasonable person to leave the workplace environment. And sometimes when employees leave jobs and it's not constructive discharge, it makes it very difficult to pursue ADA claims as well. That cuts off claims for damages. So if a workplace is intolerable, it's intolerable. But just be aware that if you leave a job, that alone is not enough to establish a constructive discharge. Now we have some tips for employers. Modify any anti-discrimination or anti-harassment training to include disability-related training, including harassment, retaliation, and reasonable accommodation requirements. I think in every employment deposition I take, there's always training on sexual harassment, and almost never is there training that the employer gives to employees on disability harassment. It's often a written sexual harassment policy. Very rarely is there a written disability harassment policy. So we think training for employers is really important. So many of these cases are supervisors who don't know the ADA, haven't been trained on it, and that gives rise to liability on behalf of the employer. I think it's important for employers to put in place disability harassment policies, grievance procedures, and make sure employees know what to do if they are subject to harassment, make sure they're clear what harassment is and what steps to take, who to report it to if they feel that they are being harassed. Supervisors should likewise be trained to respond promptly to an employee's internal complaint of harassment or retaliation. And employers should document any attempts to address it. If they are told about a situation and speak to the harasser and discipline them or have them sign some statement in order to improve their behavior, document all those attempts. That might help you down the road if there is a claim for harassment or retaliation. We have some general ADA resources here, the National Network of ADA Centers, the EEOC, Equip for Equality, and the Job Accommodation Network all have good information on this. And as we referenced, there are briefs and resources available from this subject in years past that we've done for the Great Lakes ADA Center. And a reminder, as Barry mentioned, Illinois attorneys are eligible for 1.5 hours of CLE, Continuing Legal Education credit. And just send Barry an email at the address shown there on slide 65, and we can take care of that for you. And then we thank you for participating in today's session. I think the next year's webinar series is still being formulated, so we don't have a date yet for the next webinar. So we will open it up for a question. Does anybody have any questions? I think it'll probably just be me. We're down to one mic, so.
Okay, I just want to remind everyone, if you are putting your thoughts together, go ahead and put your thoughts, comments, or questions in the chat area at this time.
I think something came in. Someone mentioned that the Satchel case, the accommodation was granted, and then the person was terminated 2 years later. Then the next question is, could the treatment of employees described in some of the harassment cases rise to the level of a basic Title I violation, failure to provide a reasonable accommodation without rising to the level of harassment? And I think yes. I think, you know, generally if it's one denial of an accommodation, that's unlikely to be harassment, but if it becomes multiple denials of an accommodation and other activities, that might be harassment. But just one denial of a reasonable accommodation is a violation of the ADA. So I think the question is a very good one. It is easier to show other ADA violations, easier to show denial of a reasonable accommodation than it is to show harassment. Because for harassment, you have to get to that severe and pervasive affecting the term of employment level. So in many situations, it might just be better to claim, you know, an unlawful denial of a reasonable accommodation or other types of discriminatory treatment. Any other questions? I guess I spoke too fast. But at least I kept my language clean, so I got that. Yeah, and we realize these cases don't come up much, but sometimes sometimes we see a lot of it, and you know, there are a lot of activities that people with disabilities get. I think people are often prone to harassment due to workplace jealousy. If someone gets a reasonable accommodation, and then their coworkers don't have that same accommodation, whether it's a staggered schedule or other treatment, there can be resentment from the coworkers to the employee with a disability. And I think oftentimes that resentment can lead to workplace harassment, and that again goes back to training. I think if employers train their staff on reasonable accommodations and how some people may need accommodations, but these must be kept confidential. And we try to do that for any employer who needs assistance. I think that goes a long way towards helping eliminate that type of issue. I see we have another question here. Do you keep your eye on issues in higher education? Are there any significant differences from the employment context? Well, one, we do keep our eyes on. We've had cases, we ended up not filing on it, but we had cases where teachers sometimes have to give accommodations, and sometimes teachers don't like the fact that the student disability office decided that they should give accommodations. So we've had teachers, you know, mention the students who have received the accommodations, even though that was inappropriate, or sometimes repeat things and speak directly to them, kind of singling them out or outing their disability. So we do see these issues in higher education as well. I haven't seen many cases on school type of harassment in post-secondary ed under Titles II or III. I'm not sure if a court would adapt it that you have to show the same severe and pervasive type of conduct. But again, if it's situations where you're supposed to get an accommodation but the teacher is not giving you the accommodation, that might be a much more straightforward claim than saying it's harassment or something like that. That's another good question. We definitely do see that in education as well. Yeah, and sometimes it also can fall into retaliation if it's resentment due to getting the accommodations that can be deemed more more retaliation than harassment, which is a slightly easier standard. You don't have to get to that severe and pervasive type of standard. So in education, it could be harassment or it could be retaliation, depending on the situation. Any other questions?
Okay, I don't see any more questions at this time. So I just want to thank Barry and Alan for all this information and their efforts on the legal brief. I encourage you to download them and make note of the current one they just added with the materials today, and visit our website, adagreatlakes.org, and look at the publication section under our services page, and you'll see the previous legal briefs that Barry and Alan have prepared for us on various topics there. Just want to inform you that this session is being recorded, and we will archive the session along with a copy of the materials on our archive page. And you can visit our archive page at www.ada-audio.org. Also, at this time, as Alan mentioned, we do not have the schedule for the new fiscal year, but I encourage you to keep visiting the schedule page on the ad-audio.org website so you can see the schedule as soon as it's posted. We will send an email blast informing you when we post it, the schedule as well, so keep an eye out for both messages and keep looking at our website. Thank you, Barry and Alan, and thank you for your patience with working with technology. We had a couple of glitches, but you guys made it work. And with that, I will conclude today's session. To exit, you can click on the X in the upper right-hand corner, and that will remove you from the webinar platform. Thank you, and have a good day.